KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Those of us who've been here for a while know the way Boeing works. You have the expansions and the contractions, and we eventually try to find places for everybody.
It was bad enough to have one Canadian involved in this. Now a second, this is really not good for reputation around the world, and it's not what we want to see.
Remember this. True courage is about knowing not when to take a life, but when to spare one.
What the Boeing layoffs will mean. We're going to take that up. We're also going to talk about Canada's involvement in the Algerian gas plant terrorist attacks. And we're going to talk about movies that books that have been turned into movies, how you feel about them. But first,
this is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. This morning on Morning Edition, KUOW's Ruby DeLuna brought us a story of a family that was affected by the 1993 E. coli outbreak. The FDA now is proposing sweeping changes to the way the food system operates, and that's the next story. Ruby, how does our food system, safety system, work now?
Well, you could describe it as more reactive than preventive, and usually it responds to an outbreak rather than preventing one in the first place. I spoke with Bill Marler. He's a Seattle attorney who specializes in food safety laws. He also represented a lot of the families who were affected by the E. coli outbreak in 1993, so he's quite familiar with it, and he's also familiar with the legislation that led to these new food safety rules.
A lot of times what happens in outbreaks is that the consumer is the canary in the coal mine. And then they get sick, and then you do a recall, you do a trace back, and then you figure out what happened. To me, that's a really bad way of producing food.
That's Bill Marler talking about how we operate now. Ruby DeLuna, what are these new changes proposing, and what's affected?
Okay, so the new rules will affect produce and processed foods. And by produce, I mean vegetables, leafy greens, fruit, processed foods like peanut butter. And the idea behind it is to prevent outbreaks before these products go to market.
And what that does is it says to companies, you need to figure out what the risks are to your process. You need to figure out how to solve them, and then you need to document and test to make sure that you're abiding by your rules.
When are these rules coming into effect from the FDA?
Well, the rules just came out. It came out in January, and the FDA is taking public comments, and that's going to continue through mid-May. Once the rules are finalized and published, it's going to be about 20 months after the rules are published for the regulations to take effect.
On Morning Edition tomorrow morning, Ruby DeLuna is going to take a closer look at those rules and regulations, what's in them and what's not in them. Thanks, Ruby.
You're welcome.
Now we turn to Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. Hello, Vaughn.
Hello, Steve.
Good to talk to you. There's been more information about Canadians' involvement in an Algerian gas plant terrorism attack. What have we learned?
Well, when the attack occurred, a terrifying attack, a whole bunch of people killed, hostages and terrorists together, the Algerian government came out and said there were Canadians involved right off the top. And other authorities said so, too. The Canadian government's reaction was, well, we're going to need to see proof. Well, we've got the proof. There's DNA evidence, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and Security Services have looked at it and concluded, yes, there were two people with Canadian passports, which made them Canadians, involved in this. And the police are now looking whether or not there were associates here in Canada, whether or not there were people who are helping them here in Canada. But if you recall when we talked about this a while back, Steve, the problem here is the Canadian passport, the continuing problem with border crossing, with Canadian security and passports, the notion that there's an awful lot of people out there who have Canadian passports, who had a relatively easy time getting them, who aren't even in Canada very much, but it is still smeared, fairly or not, as the passport of choice for some terrorists.
Yeah, and so how is Canada responding with some changes?
Well, I think the first thing they're doing is obviously, you know, I have to say maybe a little sheepishly, conceding the Algerians were right and trying to give as much assistance as they can in whether or not there was any co-conspirator assistance from here. You may remember at about the same time there were revelations that a Canadian passport carrier was involved in that attack in Bulgaria on the bus load of Israeli tourists. Again, just saying Canadian passport may give the impression to people that, you know, people are leaving Canada and going out and freelancing terrorism. The problem is more nuanced than that. The problem is people who have Canadian passports legitimately, but who haven't been in Canada for a long time. People who are entitled to get Canadian passports because they were born here or their parents were born here. And people who are using Canadian passports as false identity travel documents, and you're getting all three mixed up. So at this point, while the RCMP have certainly conceded that these people were Canadians, they haven't put out an awful lot more detail than that. They sent a squad of people over to Algeria to check it out. They've dug in a little more. So far, one of the reasons that people were saying these were Canadians off the top, if you'll recall, is because one of the hostages was told by a guy, well, you know, look, we're Canadians. So they identified themselves up front. They spoke fluent English. There is also a set of allegations from witnesses that one of them was a Canadian of Chechen origin. So more to be done here, but I think the real problem for Canada is our passport getting a bad name around the world.
You know, I noticed in reading some of these articles that the Canadian authorities are also concerned that there may be folks holding these passports in Syria.
Yes. So, yeah, there's Syria. Well, there's the Bulgarian incident. There's Algeria, and it's Canadians. I mean, like a lot of people, we have kind of an opinion of ourselves that's sort of high, and regard ourselves as harmless around the world. I think if we all find that our passports are getting scrutinized a lot more carefully, we're going to be taken aback at that. But you know, what you can do about the ones that are already out there is tougher. And here's how that plays to another story that's developing. And if you, particularly, I don't know the coverage in the American media on this one, Steve, but if you go through the Canadian papers and radio and TV coverage, there have been more and more alarmist stories on our side of the border about border lineups this summer. Not strictly because of the passport issue, although I wouldn't blame Americans if they were checking our passports more carefully, but because of the impact of the sequester on border staffing on the American side of the border, the fact that the dollar, the American and Canadian dollar are at par means it's, you know, a great time for cross-border shopping for a lot of people, but people are being told in Canada, be prepared for long lineups at the border this summer because the American side of the border just isn't going to be staffed at the level it has been in the past.
One of the first consequences of the sequester. Huh, interesting.
I think that's true, and as I understand it, and you'd probably know this more in detail, people have to be given notice for layoffs or for reduced work hours, and I think that starts to kick in April. So I came across the border last evening. I'm on my way to Oregon, and there was not a, you know, it was easy. The border was well-staffed, and it was very straightforward. But what we're told is that the staffing levels that we're seeing now may be the staffing levels this summer as well, when normally, as you would expect, there's a lot more staff at the border.
Oh, man. Hey, Bonnie, are you going back to Ashland again?
I'm going down to take a quick look at the Spring Theater Festival in Ashland because as you know, Steve, got an election in British Columbia in May. The opinion polls point to the likelihood of a change of government. We haven't had a change of government in BC for 12 years, so I'm expecting a very, very busy spring. Just with the election, and then if we get a change of government, busy. So I thought if we're going to squeeze in a quick visit to Ashland and see what's on this year, I better get it in over the Easter weekend. So that's what I'm doing.
You are a fan.
Yeah.
You are
and
a fan.
Doing My Fair Lady this year.
Is that right?
That famous Shakespearean musical comedy. They're doing King Lear in the Little Theater. I'm looking forward to that. Two different actors playing Lear, so I may have to go back and see the other one after I see this one. And they're doing another August Wilson. So I've been trying to get that entire sequence of 10 plays that he did on the African American experience in the United States. So they're doing two trains running, which I've never seen. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's great. That's great. Say, Vaughn.
And since we're on the playwright news, Robert Schenken, the Seattle playwright,
yeah.
Did the All the Way with LBJ play that was there last summer. I know it was in Seattle in the fall. I saw a reference in, I think, the Seattle Times that he's doing a second play on Lyndon Johnson. That the first one was so successful, he's going to take another slice of Johnson's term as president and do a play on that as well.
Well, if Robert Caro can write four plus 800,000 page books, why not?
Yeah. No, we're waiting. Caro's 70 years old. I'm hanging in there with him, hoping he gets the thing finished.
Wow. All right, tell me something. I always enjoy having discussions about sewage with you. So yeah. This is not about Victoria building a sewage treatment plant. This is another Victoria sewage issue.
Yes. So let me be clear. I do not think it's funny that Victoria continues to dump raw sewage in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. I perfectly understand the outrage that Americans feel about us doing this and thinking we can get away with it, for we've been planning to deal with it now for going on 30 years. What I do find entertaining as a political columnist is the continuing local battle over finding new ways to stall this project. So, we have agreed. We're building a sewage treatment plant at the entrance to Victoria Harbor. If you've ever come into the city on the Coho or Port Angeles, or if you've come in on the Clipper out of Seattle, or walked around Victoria Harbor, right at the entranceway there will be a lovely new sewage treatment plant. However, it turns out that the way we're planning to treat our sewage, we need a second plant called the sludge plant. And isn't that an attractive name? I'm sure it wasn't the public relations agency that came up with that. And it's been called a secret meeting. At a meeting just a week ago, the regional district, the regional government for the provincial capital, chose a location for the sludge plant. It is going to be in a neighborhood in Esquimalt. And people are very, very upset that they're going to be next to the sludge plant because they feel it was dumped on them without warning. No local consultation. Victoria paper yesterday, Steve, had a piece on the front page on a guy and his wife who bought a house last week that will border on the sludge plant. And they didn't know it was coming. And they're concerned, obviously, about smell and disruption in the neighborhood and just having, well, sewage treatment dumped on them without warning and consultation. So we're going through another round of protests. I don't know if the government's going to be able to stick to that location for the sludge plant. They may have to look for somewhere else to put it.
Oh, my. Well, Vaughn, we'll be happy to send you our compost.
2018, Steve.
What's that?
We're still going to be treating it, and I think we should invite people from Washington State up for the ribbon cutting.
I'll come. I'll come. And like I say, we'll bring you some of our compost.
Ribbon cuttings at sewage treatment plants, or do they cut something else? I don't know. Anyway.
All right, Vaughn, have a good time on your trip to Ashland.
I will, and bring you up to speed next week on what's shaking down there, too.
Good. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday on Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Ten 19. Movies made from books. When does it work and when does it not? That's next.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC. The Sounders FC have advanced to the semifinal round of the CONCACAF Champions League, where they'll renew their rivalry with Mexico's Santos Laguna Tuesday, April 2nd at CenturyLink Field. Ticket information is at soundersfc.com.
52 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says we should expect some showers this afternoon and a high today of 59. It's 10:20. The financial crisis in the island nation of Cyprus could wind up affecting people in Spain and Italy. We'll find out how and why in 20 minutes.
Robert Horton, who is our film critic, joins us today. That's right, sans theme.
Where's the music?
Sans theme, because we like to mix it up.
Wow.
And you know what? That theme is something that perhaps people would associate with bad movies from good books. And so we wanted to just leave that clean.
Okay.
Because we thought we would ask you about your favorite book that was turned into a movie, and was it just horribly disappointing? We want specifics. Or was it great? You thought, oh man, it was wonderful. And yes, book, movie, different. But sometimes, you know, one bleeds into the other and taints your enjoyment. So 206-543-5869 is our number. Robert Horton is film critic for the Herald and Everett for this August radio station, where he's been coming to us for as long as I can remember, and also writes at his blog, The Crop Duster. Good to see you.
Hi, Steve.
That was a long introduction.
That was. I almost I drifted off there for a moment. But
we could have made a movie about that introduction, and it would not have been very good.
No.
What prompts this conversation is the appearance of the movie On the Road.
Yes, On the Road, finally released. It opened last Friday in Seattle. And, of course, it's based on the novel by Jack Kerouac that came out in 1957. And ever since then, actually, people have been talking about, you know, when are they going to make a movie out of On the Road? Various people have tried it. Francis Coppola was involved for many years trying to produce something. And actually, I think he's still got his finger in on this one, but in a very faraway way, and he never got it done. At the time, actually in 1957, when the book became a kind of instant sensation, Jack Kerouac, somebody at a studio, it may have been Warner Brothers, thought it would be, wouldn't it be great if Jack Kerouac played the lead role in the movie?
Wow.
A role that is sort of based on him anyway.
Yeah.
Thinly disguised. And you know, because he was the representative of the beat culture, and wouldn't that be kind of interesting if they did that? And he wrote a letter, which you can find online if you Google it probably, to Marlon Brando, pleading with Marlon Brando to play the other lead role in the film.
Dean Moriarty?
Yeah, the vagabond driver, Dean Moriarty. And I don't know if Brando ever responded to that, but that never came to anything. Although that would have been... That probably would have been a complete mess, but it would have been an interesting movie, I think, especially if they were improvising part of it, which was probably part of the spirit of it. But that never got made, and it has been made today. It got made by filmmaker Walter Salles, who is the guy who made The Motorcycle Diaries a few years ago, which had quite a bit of road movie appeal to it.
Oh, yeah.
Shot in South America. Actually, based on some of the early experiences of Che Guevara. So he's not, doesn't seem like a complete mismatch in terms of some of his former stuff. But I saw the film. I have lived with the novel for now a long time in my life. And I kind of got intrigued by this idea of, you know, what do you do when not just a book that gets made into a movie. I mean, you know, if they make a movie of 50 Shades of Grey, you're going to go see it, Steve, and you'll say, this is not like the book that I love. You know,
no kidding.
But that's like a year that you've lived with it. I'm interested in books that you've known for much of your life, and you cherish them, and you've read them, and everyone has this experience. You've made a movie in your head, you know, as you've read it. Maybe you've cast it. You know what people look like and how it feels and everything. And then you see the movie, and it just, you know, can't possibly live up to that. And in the case of, I will say that On the Road, it was a pretty profound disappointment, I think. I don't think it's a very good movie to begin with.
I am shocked. But,
yeah, it certainly does not. It certainly messes with, or it falls short of your own expectations, you know, the way that you've lived with it over the years and imagined it and kind of...
See, I just wouldn't go see it.
You wouldn't see it at all because you'd be afraid of that fall off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just because I want the book and the story of the book to remain my story. Sometimes I don't mind. I mean, I went to The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and I was willing to see that transformation.
Yeah. And you knew the books already?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. I read them as a kid.
That worked out okay?
Worked out okay.
Yeah.
Did you know those books?
I did not. I read the books after I saw the movies.
But there's some I just would not care to see. Now, you know, they're remaking again The Great Gatsby. I've seen how many versions of that have there been?
There've been a couple of big screen versions.
Redford version, yeah. Redford Mia Farrow.
That's the most familiar one.
And I'm happy to see that.
You're curious about that one. That one,
yeah.
Okay.
And I don't feel the same. I guess it's about your feeling about the book, isn't it?
I think so. I think if you have a kind of proprietary feeling of it, and it depends how deep it goes with you. But you know, On the Road is one of those books that kind of goes deep with many of us, especially if it hits you at a young age and you're susceptible. And
just can't imagine people could make a good version of On the Road. You know, I'm going to go to a couple of phone calls here. I also posted this question on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Like us. We need to get up to more likes. We need 5,000 people in the liking department, because I believe at 5,000, then we have the ability to say 5,000 people like us on Facebook.
Well, they're going to like this.
So Russell wrote, can't wait to see how Ender's Game turns out. Now, that was a very popular book. A lot of fans, science fiction fans, and others loved Ender's Game.
I haven't read that, but yes.
Deco writes, I haven't seen it yet, but the Admission trailer sure depicts a far zanier movie made from a lovely, wry, unsentimental novel. And this is this movie with Tina Fey and
Paul Rudd.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because of course, sometimes it's about books that aren't well known. Lots of movies come from books that aren't that well known.
It is sometimes easier to get away with an adaptation when the book is not well known. You can actually make a better film out of that. What she's talking about, that the trailer seems off, that's also a thing that plays into it, because even if you hear the casting, like the movie that came out of Jack Reacher at Christmas time, long before that film came out, people were saying Tom Cruise is going to play this role. There's absolutely no way Tom Cruise can play this role, and the movie was sort of dead to that part of the fan base that just based on a single piece of casting. In that case was because I think the character he plays is supposed to be 6'6" or something, and so there's your challenge right there.
All right, well, here's Ian, who's on Beacon Hill, who joins us. Ian, what did you like about The Princess Bride book and movie?
Well, I have to say the movie, of course, I feel like is in some ways more famous than the book. And when I was young, I had seen the movie, and a friend gave me the book, and I realized that, I don't know if you remember in The Princess Bride, but there's this whole sort of double plot going on where the grandfather is reading to the young boy.
Oh, yeah.
I assumed that was, you know, a convention for the movie. But it turns out that that's actually in the book, and that the book and the movie are extremely similar, and because of that, both of them, I think, were even more enjoyable.
I have never read the book. I thought the movie was so much fun. That's good to hear that they played with them both on bringing them to equal footing. Do you remember? Did you ever read the book?
I've never read the book, no. But the movie is now kind of safely become a classic.
Yeah.
I don't know how well the book was known when the movie was made.
Yeah.
I don't remember that it was considered a big, you know, violation of the original.
Yeah. All right, Ian, I appreciate that. Chris is in West Seattle. Chris, The Razor's Edge, was that Mom?
Yes.
And which version of the movie did you see, Chris?
I saw The Razor's Edge starring Bill Murray when I was about 15 years old.
Oh, yeah, that was Bill Murray's, some people called it a vanity project. You liked it. You liked that movie?
I loved the movie. And I was thinking to myself at the time, the book is always better than the movie. And I went to pick up the book, and it was horrible. I had a lot of trouble reading it because it was so bad. I don't know why, but it seems to be the one exception where in every other case I've ever seen, the book is always better.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's always
Well, I like the book, and I knew the book before the movie, so I can't agree with you on that one. That's one where I like the book a lot.
Was it Cornel Wilde or Tyrone Power who did Eraser's
Edge? It was Tyrone Power who did the version. I think it's an interesting film. It's a little bit staid, but it's got a great cast in it. So.
Now, I remember when the Eraser's Edge came out with Bill Murray, everybody panned it, but I have not seen it. But Chris, you say it was good. You enjoyed it.
Yeah, honestly, to this day, I'd say it's in my top 10 favorite movies.
That's good.
Wow.
I appreciate that.
That's interesting. I mean, it would be a movie like that, I guess, hitting you when you were 15 would seem, you know, like something really unusual that you hadn't thought about. A man on a quest for spiritual knowledge.
It's
a weird film, though, with Bill Murray in it. A very odd.
Was it Bill Murray it Bill Murray, you know, that's sort of the Bill Murray of the, you know, that Bill Murray?
Yes. You could say that it indicates that Bill Murray would become the star of Jim Jarmusch films and Wes Anderson films, which we didn't know at the time in 1984, I think, was that when that Razor's Edge came out.
Let me read you. I want to go to a couple more phones here, but let me read you a couple of quick emails. And this one is interesting to me from Dwight. I vote for Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. As a excellent film. A book turned into a film. Yeah. Excellent representation of getting unstuck in time. Soundtrack with Glenn Gould playing Bach. Typing hits turning into gunshots of World War II. Just a great movie adapted from a great book.
Well, that's interesting because he brings up, you know, an author who has proved very difficult to turn into movies. And Vonnegut books have not turned out all that well, mostly in my opinion. But I would say he's right. Slaughterhouse-Five was a very – it's probably impossible to adapt that and get it exactly right, but that is certainly a very sincere and intriguing adaptation.
And that fits your example of a book that for older folks, when that movie came out, I mean that novel had already been with us for almost 20 years, I think.
I don't know about – not quite that long probably, but yeah, it did – I mean it meant a lot.
The movie was in the 70s, right?
Yeah. It meant a lot to people, that's for sure. Slaughterhouse-Five was something that you know, generationally, really kind of hit the – and the movie was not a big success, though.
No, is that right?
Yeah.
Chris writes, Dune, sigh. Donald writes, The Heiress, a beautiful movie which captured the essence of Washington Square by Henry James without the book's endless exposition.
Oh, that Henry James and all that.
Too many notes. Easy Peasy echoes the name of the rose. I've seen the movie once again, was inclined to be more charitable, but trying to make a movie out of it was the sheerest hubris. Let's see, that was Sean Connery and
Christian Slater in one of the early roles.
When he got to actually do interesting things.
F. Murray Abraham, I think, was in there.
A particularly bad example of a book to movie would be Never Cry Wolf, Farley Mowat's book. I like the movie, but I admit I never read the book.
I never read the book either. From what I know of the book, it is a book that is cherished by people, and so they might indeed feel kind of protective of it. I thought the movie was okay.
Movies that I think did justice to the original books, Daniel Lean writes, Harry Potter volumes, A River Runs Through It, Little Big Man, Dr. Zhivago, The Bridge on the River Kwai. No, I'm not related to David Lean, he writes.
Uh-huh.
Zane's in Ballard. Zane, what was a book that turned into a movie that either was you were grateful for or disappointed you?
Hi. I love hearing this discussion with, you know, The Razor's Edge and The Princess Bride all thrown in together. The two movies that really come out as examples for me, kind of counterexamples whenever this discussion comes up, is two movies that I really enjoyed, and then I went back and read the books, and I was distinctly underwhelmed by the books, was Forrest Gump. And the book was kind of rambling, and I felt like, you know, they had taken a so-so book and made a really great movie out of it. And the other one was the Kevin Costner movie, Dances with Wolves. The book struck me as just kind of a second-rate pulp western. It wasn't anything particularly special.
Maybe that's the best books to choose.
Well, it does go to a theory that many people have, that you can make a better film out of a book that just has kind of a good idea in it, but maybe isn't a great literary masterpiece, and create something on screen rather than trying to, you know, take Dostoevsky or something, and you necessarily have to then narrow it down and streamline it and cut out a lot of what is Dostoevsky, and you end up with a movie that is sort of, what is that? It's because it's not Dostoevsky. And
it, I mean, we can say that about Dickens too, right?
You could say that about a lot of things. At least Dickens is a, well, no, I won't say that.
He's no Henry James.
He's a good storyteller. Well, yes, he doesn't have all those words.
Max, Zane, thanks. Max in Seattle. Mac, books are always better?
In my opinion, for the most part, yes. Hello?
Yes, yeah, we're listening.
We're
hanging on your spoken and written word.
Yeah, I'm been a writer all my life, and I'm going to school for film and hoping to break into the industry as a director. And I always love this discussion because, particularly when I get into discussions with other writers and directors, and there's always been this propensity, it seems like for me, that one of the arguments for directors and so forth as to why is there always this propensity of taking a book and going and completely changing it. Changing it, even if they only take a couple of points in changing it, but if you read the book, you're looking at it and going, that has no semblance of the book whatsoever.
Yeah, but of course, that's exactly the question people are raising, right?
I mean, yeah, that's the transformational thing. I mean, you have to, you can't, in most 99.9% of the cases, you can't shoot the book, so you have to change it, and you have to cut things, and you have to arrange things, and maybe invent things. And it's very rare when you have something like, I'll pick an example, The Maltese Falcon, great novel by Dashiell Hammett. And it was made a couple of times into a movie already, and then John Huston had the brilliant idea of just making it the way it was written. And he took a lot of dialogue from The Maltese Falcon and did a brilliant job of casting the movie, but kind of stuck to the original thing, and actually it's extremely close to Hammett, and it turned out to be a terrific film. But there's only so many kinds of books that you can do that with, and with certain kinds of literary novels, it's extremely difficult.
A short and terse book, too, The Maltese Falcon.
Lend itself to that, yeah.
A great adaptation for me is Conrack, Pamela writes, from Pat Conroy's The Water is Wide, starring John Voight. How about that?
Well, you don't hear that one brought up very often. Yeah.
Tell No One, French film based on a Harlan Coben book. Movie is so incredibly beautiful and moving, I won't go back and read the book. I can't have it ruined. I don't watch movies more than once, with the exception of this one. It's gorgeous. So a newer book, though, too, right? Right? That's a little bit newer.
I haven't read the book. I don't know. The movie's a lot of fun,
I'm coming to a phone call you're going to like in a minute. Okay. But here's Lee writes, The Best, English Patient. Couldn't stand the book, but it's a pretty good movie for me. The Worst, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. One of my all-time favorite books, which I lived with a long time, as Robert says, in a completely unwatchable movie.
Yeah, that gets to what we're talking about, because that's one of those books that people tend to cling to and reread and then, you know, live by and take that with them, even if they're getting rid of all the other books and so on. And when the movie comes along, it just can't quite get it.
I would never compare the two. The Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas was of a piece that I have watched the movie, and I have enjoyed the film, but I would never allow it to, though it has the same title, would not allow it to bleed over into the way I've read and enjoyed the book.
So you've compartmentalized those two things, yes.
I could not allow it to, because the book was...
Well, that's probably good.
But I can't do that with On the Road.
Yeah.
All right, Chris is in Kirkland. Chris, what was the movie and book you're thinking about?
Well, when I heard all the Oscar buzz about Silver Linings Playbook, I decided that before I went to see the movie, I'd read the book. Absolutely loved the book. I thought, you know, I can't wait to see this movie. Went out, and I was mad. I was mad sitting there in the theater because I thought they took all the charming parts and the interesting parts out of the book and just wiped them out of the movie. And I know they have to cut a movie down, but, I mean, making Robert De Niro's character a bookie, and, I didn't get it. I just thought that all the charming parts of the characters were gone. And yeah. I was watching the movie and going, I don't get what everybody loves about this
one. Well, do you think if you hadn't read the book, do you think you would have liked the movie more?
Probably, most likely, but it was just a, it seemed like it was just a story, just kind of a typical story, whereas in the book, they were able to delve into a lot more of what was going on in his head and the family dynamics. All the family dynamics in the movie were really, I thought, glossed over. If you read the book, you see, you know, people think there's a lot of family dynamics in the movie, but the book really got into it.
That's very interesting, and I wanted to end with that because you really liked that movie, but you never read the book.
Yeah, it's a very, very fun
movie. Stay away from the book now.
No, the book, and the book wasn't a big book. The director found it and liked it and decided to pursue it. But.
Yeah. All right, Chris, I appreciate that. And Sam was on Capitol Hill, said Lonesome Dove, best adaptation. And then Jim wrote Little Big Man, the movie was wonderful. Then read the book. The movie's images only enhance the wonderfulness of the book.
Okay.
How about that?
So he's going at it the other direction.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that can work.
All right. There are a lot of great emails here. And if anybody we were having a conversation of it over at the Weekday on KUW Facebook page. Love you to put your responses on that on Weekday on KUW so people can see some of your thoughts about it as well. And Tanya writes, read Princess Bride, she says.
Okay.
That was one of my top movies from a book. And she's saying, read it. So
read the book,
I'm
too.
I'm there. We better read it.
Yes, yes, I will.
All right, Robert.
Well, I would leave it by saying that there are a number of authors who have kind of wisely said, I think Stephen King was one of them, that when people come up to them and say, oh, what do you think about the fact that they ruined your book by turning it into a movie, that he said, you know, they didn't ruin the book. It's sitting there on the shelf. Not one word has been changed. You can read it anytime you want. So you just have to roll with these things when they mess with your images.
I like that. Robert Horton, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Weekday.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Let's all go to the lobby and continue the conversation on Facebook. It's Weekday on KUOW. 1041, I'm Bernard Ouellette. How Cyprus's financial woes could expand to affect citizens of other nations in a minute.
KUOW and FIRST, for inspiration and recognition of science and technology, present the Seattle Regional High School Robotics Competition, March 29th through 30th at CenturyLink Field Event Center. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
Mike was a 25-year-old white guy. Victor was a 10-year-old black kid. Mike adopted Victor. Not everyone approved.
One coworker came over to me telling me that puppies belong with puppies and kittens belong with kittens.
Mike and Victor against the world, and then against each other. Next time on The Story.
This afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2.
Support for KUOW comes from the attorneys of Foster Pepper, providing legal counsel on employment and labor issues to employers throughout the region, online at foster.com and on Twitter. When it happens, Foster Pepper is there.
We'll get caught up on today's proceedings at the Supreme Court in about 20 minutes.
Michael Parks is here. We're giving him a new title. What were you saying? Michael Parks is?
Well, self-taught economist, professional speaker, blogger, used to be a newspaper man, used to be a newsletter publisher.
And former ink-stained wretch.
Former ink-stained wretch, exactly.
All right, you came in with this has very little to do with our topic, but maybe it does. You came in with a hat for NHTSA tractors and farm equipment, does it say?
NHTSA tractor and implement.
Implements. Now, NHTSA, Oregon is at the end of the earth.
It is.
And up near the Idaho border. I have some friends who are from there.
About 5 miles inside the Idaho border, I have a sister and a brother-in-law who are cattle ranching. Just bought a piece of farmland that they're turning into a cattle ranch. The exciting part of visiting them, Steve, was that they took me to the Owyhee Canyon and Owyhee Reservoir. And I have to tell your listeners, my reaction was, move over, Crater Lake.
I don't like to tell people about southeastern Oregon.
It's really, it's wonderful.
It's amazing. Wonderful. It is the American Outback, as they call it, and it is.
You have it to yourself. We drove to the dam and then drove 3 or 4 miles beyond the dam as far as the road goes. There were a few fly fishers.
There's rafters that come down a little later.
And there were a few people sitting in the hot tub at the hot springs, right on the river, hot water flowing into the river that creates kind of a natural hot tub. A couple of families with the cooler full of beer and the kids playing. It was just wonderful.
You know, did you go into Jordan Valley?
I did not.
So at Jordan Valley, that's the junction of a couple of highways.
Yep.
There's a wall there that was built by Basque sheepherders so they could play their version of handball.
Whatever, yeah.
And then a little further, there's these rock formations that are named for different Roman ruins. Rome.
That's
an amazing area.
The scenery in the Waiheke Canyon, it blows your socks away. We also, the part of the trip was I spent four or five nights in the Cactus League. Saw five games over... How many games did I see? 6 games over 5 days, 4 parks, 11 teams, including the Netherlands, that were participating in the World Baseball Classic. And I'm happy to say that the Mariners won both games that I attended. And then after that, we drove through the eastern part of Nevada to get to southern Idaho. Stayed overnight, Ely, Nevada, Hotel Nevada, first high-rise, first fireproof building in Nevada. First hotel in Nevada. We stayed in a room that was named for a Hollywood actress whose name escapes me at the moment. But
I know that hotel.
Do you?
Yes.
Do you?
Now, by any chance, did you go into the Great Basin National Park near there?
We did not, but I put
go back there.
I put that on my radar screen. I see you have to go a ways because I think the entrance is on the east side.
Yeah.
You have to go into Utah to get to it, don't you?
No, you can get to it from the north, too.
Yeah.
It's an amazing park because
you've been there, obviously.
Yeah. My son and I went there on a big drive, and you start in the basin, you know, in the flat, high desert, dry, and you wind your way up this road, and it's one big mountain, really.
Yes.
And by the time you're at the top, you're back in Colorado. You're in birch trees and aspens, rather, and beautiful water.
Right. You go from the low desert to the high,
and they have caves.
Yeah.
Interesting limestone caves there.
That whole area of eastern Nevada, we drove from the outskirts of Las Vegas to Twin Falls, Idaho. And every time I turned around, I said, wow, mark me down as a simpleton, an easy mark for scenery, but it's just fascinating. It's cattle country. It's mining country. The copper mine outside of Ely closed a few years ago, but has reopened. And one of the features of Ely, Nevada these days are these massive open dump trucks rumbling through town, taking copper ore from an open pit mine about 8 miles west of the city, probably to a railhead where they get railed off for refining someplace.
Well, I believe you have made the connection back to the topics of our of our segment, which is about the economy of the Pacific Northwest.
Absolutely.
And here we are still reminding us that we are a resource-dependent economy for all the high-tech, for all of Boeing's strength. We are a resource-dependent economy as well.
In our travels, we saw lots of agricultural activity, and we need to remind ourselves that after airplanes, agricultural products in all their forms were the second largest exports and have been growing very rapidly. We're in great situation with Pacific Northwest agriculture to serve the growing middle class in Pacific Asia, which wants to get the same diseases we have, right? Diabetes and obesity and so forth. They want to eat lots of red meat, lots of grain-fed beef and so forth. Lots of carbs, lots of potatoes, for example.
Oh, there's one way to look at it.
That's right.
And I relate that to Cyprus now, if you will.
Well, I'm not sure there's direct connection.
There's nobody that out on a limb in the eastern Oregon banks that they'll be affected by a Cyprus run on the banks.
You know, the seed that Cyprus plants is that your insured bank deposits are not safe.
That's what we're learning.
Because
somebody's taking a haircut and it's the depositors.
We crossed a Rubicon. Until this week, a euro in a Cyprus bank was the equivalent of a euro in an Italian or Spanish or German or Finland bank. But this morning or yesterday morning or after the weekend, a euro in the Bank of Cyprus in an account, mind you, that's over 100,000 euros. So at least depositors below that level less than 100,000 euros were protected. But over 100,000 euros, they're going to take not a small haircut, but a very large haircut. I don't think the percentage has been determined. Maybe
I heard 40.
I heard 40, yes.
So you think it might? 40. Maybe it varies?
No, I think it will be fixed, and I think it's the deposit. It's the deposits in both of the large banks, the People's Bank, which is the smaller one, and the Bank of Cyprus. Do you know, Steve, I looked last night, the Cyprus banks were still closed yesterday.
I thought they were supposed to open up later today.
Well, they were supposed to open Tuesday, and then they were supposed to open Monday. And are they open? I'm not sure. So the island is devastated. They're operating on cash.
They're not open yet.
As a part of the resolution of these banks, there will be capital controls. The cash machines are now dispensing 100 euros. Last week, they were dispensing 240 euros. A Rubicon has been crossed. It's a reminder of a couple of things. First, that the great financial crisis of 2008, post the Lehman bankruptcy, is not over. Secondly, that the banking system in Europe is much weaker than the banking system in the United States. Notice that there's no stress on our banking system. Our stock markets are flirting with new highs. The volatility, the VIX index is very low. You also have to keep in mind that Cyprus represents 0.2% of the Eurozone economy. And also, an important angle, one of the reasons they're bailing in the depositors in Cypriot banks is because a lot of the money is of questionable provenance from
right.
Russia. So, you know, on one side, you can say this is a way to make the oligarchs in Russia pay for their sins. I was reading, however, a back issue of The Economist this morning that notes that when it comes to banking havens, the Caribbean countries and Cyprus have nothing on Miami.
Is that right?
Or nothing on Delaware, which is home to thousands and thousands of brass plate companies who are there because for tax reasons and for other reasons.
But the Cyprus haircut
yes.
loss is being imposed across the board.
Absolutely.
Right? So
yep.
somebody could be a legitimate business person with 100,000 plus in Cyprus.
There is a little wiggle room. Today's Economist says the Cyprus finance minister is saying we may make an exception for companies that can prove that they need access to their deposits for normal commercial transactions, a restaurant to pay suppliers, for example, or a shipping company to pay for fuel. So it raises enormous numbers of questions, but the key thing is that for the first time in the European financial crisis, the depositors have been bailed in, and deposit insurance is essentially out the window as we understand it.
Help me understand a little bit about what that means for where's that money going?
Well, the money gets taken out of the accounts and I think given to the Cyprus government, which needs to pay its employees. In return for the deposits, the depositors will get equity in a bad bank, which will hold the bad assets, including Greek bonds, for heaven's sakes, that the banks in Cyprus. I mean, the banks in Cyprus got all this money from Russia. They had to find some place to put it. And so some of it was invested in Greek bonds. And you remember, I think, the last bailout in Greece. There have been two, one in 2010 and one in 2012. The last one bailed in Greek bondholders. Greek bondholders had to take a haircut. And therefore, the net worth and the loans that Cyprus had made were worth a lot less. Suddenly, they're squeezed, and the Cyprus banking system is 8 or 9 times the size of its economy. Not unremarkable, because the banking or corporate deposits in Delaware would be much larger than its economy. London, New York, this is true in lots of areas of the world.
How does this make you feel about the fact that our banking system is still run by the same people who brought us the problems in the first place?
I feel very bad about that. Our banks are too big to manage. They're too big to fail. I'm talking about the top 5 or 6 I love the solution that's being proposed by Richard Fisher, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, who says that all bankers should have to sign a contract, especially the big ones, that says we can do anything we want with private money that is not covered by deposit insurance. But the contract says if we lose, we go broke and the taxpayers are unaffected. We need to break up these big banks, which are too large to fail and too large to
move. Isn't he basically arguing for a de facto Glass-Steagall return?
I don't know if he would put it that way. Certainly a modification of deposit insurance rules, which takes the guarantee that comes with deposit insurance and the implicit guarantee of a government bailout away from the risky activities. We've learned more and more about the London Whales activities, and it's very discouraging. The bank covered up the activity. They didn't know at the top of the executive suite what the devil the London Whale was doing, and they said, well, we're hedging. But it turns out it was a bet. And it was a bet made simply to make a big profit.
Talk to the guy who was the inspector general for the TARP, Neil Borofsky, who wrote a book, Bailout, angry about the fact that people were not prosecuted, could have been. Blamed Geithner and his deputies in the Obama administration.
Eric Holder, the Justice Department. We haven't gone after these
people. And they decided not to, that those people were going to escape.
And partly, I think, because they're worried about the risk, the systemic risks that criminal prosecution would encompass. Think about, you know, if you do a criminal prosecution, think of Arthur Anderson. A criminal prosecution is a death sentence. And so they're worried about that.
Of course, they're concerned that, Borofsky was concerned that the statute of limitations is going to run out on some of these guys. Yeah. All right, Boeing layoffs and how that affects the unintended consequence of the Dreamliner production being awry also.
The overriding question is, are we at the beginning of another Boeing bust? We lost roughly a third of our Boeing employment post 9/11 from September of 2001 to the summer of 2004. My guess is that we are not at the beginning of another Boeing bust, mainly because of the very large backlog, 7.5 years of production at current rates. And by the way, the backlog is growing, and that 7.5 years doesn't count the 200-odd 737s that Ryanair ordered last week. Behind that backlog is a rising middle class around the world. The advanced economies are growing. If they're growing at all, they're growing at 1% or 2%. But the emerging and developing economies are growing at 6% or 7%. And once people get their basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter, and education for their children covered, the first thing they want to do is travel. And today we travel by air mainly. So travel is one of the first uses of disposable income. As long as the global economy stays on the track, I think we're going to be okay. I do think that my friend John Talton, who sits in this seat, I think, every third week, makes a good point that we are a branch town. We have been a branch town for a decade since Boeing moved headquarters off to Chicago. I write in my blog today that if Boeing thought it could make a competitive product in Mexico or China, it would move production there in a heartbeat. But there's a great deal of inertia represented by both the physical and the human capital that it has assembled here, and I think that that's going to help us going forward.
All right, sir. He writes at MichaelJParks.com. He is the self-taught economist, professional speaker, blogger, and former ink-stained wretch. I appreciate you being in here.
I always enjoy it.
We keep saying this. We haven't done it yet, but we have to have you and Talton for a good 40 minutes to go back and forth.
I'm also a KUOW member and a radio nut.
Well, don't forget, next week is when that's we're making that call again. All right, Michael J. Parks. Weekdays produced by, let me see. Andy Hurst, Domino Sade, Jason Bagano, Katie Sewell, Bernard Ouellette's our engineer, Daniel Anthony Goodwin is our intern. By the way, let me clarify, it was a little confusing. April 3rd is when the various factions go down and present their case before the NBA Board of Governors. Then the governors will have a meeting April 18th and 19th, and then they'll decide on who gets to have that NBA team, or who knows what they'll decide. We'll keep covering it. You stay with us. Talk to you tomorrow.
Ten fifty nine. An unusual earthquake in Oklahoma a couple years ago was probably man-made, they're saying now, caused by an oil drilling procedure. We'll have more on that in the news just ahead. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, providing a variety of fresh organic fruits and vegetables, now featuring 20 pounds of Honeycrisp juicing apples. Local delivery available from Zarly.com. More information at Zarly, Zarly.com/Tiny's Organic.
This is a test of the emergency alert system. Is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. 53 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 59. It's cloudy and the forecast calls for showers. Looks like clouds and showers overnight with a low of 47. And tomorrow, Thursday, more clouds, more chances of showers. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.